thank you, Rabbi Adler. Again, it's a pleasure. I know Rabbi Adler from his days in Baltimore, and I can say that much of what he said about me, whether it's deserved or not, can certainly be said about him as well. It's also a pleasure to be in Maale Adomim. I didn't realize what a beautiful town you have, and Baruch Hashem, you're so close to Yerushalayim as well, so I'll probably pay some more visits here just to see the scenery, if nothing else. The topic I was asked to talk about tonight is not necessarily my first choice of speaking, because emotions are very high. There's a tremendous amount of pain, and sometimes there's a great sense of helplessness as well, because the truth of the matter is, we have this solution and that solution, and I'll talk about the different things that we can do, and there's certainly a lot more that we can do than we are doing, and I will admit that there are failures in our halachic institutions in some ways, but at the end of the day, HaKadosh Baruch Hu did create a world where people have free will, people can do evil things, and even the best crafted remedy will not be able to solve all problems. So I guess ahead of time, we have to be a bit pessimistic about finding the one global solution that's going to solve everybody. There was a rabbi in New York, not New York, in Atlanta, Georgia, is a bit of a left-wing, very, very left-wing Orthodox rabbi, who wants to start a campaign, says, "No aguna shall be left behind," type of thing. And it's catchy, but in reality, you know, there is a world where evildoers sometimes prosper in the short run. But still, as I say, I'm going to try to be a bit optimistic in terms of talking about things that can be done, recognizing that this is not going to be a complete solution. We know, of course, all of you know the problem of the aguna, and that is based on the idea that the Torah says a woman is not divorced, a woman cannot get out of a marriage unless the husband either dies or the husband of his own volition gives or authorizes a shaliach to give a get. And that's an interesting point, because in any secular system of law, it is not the parties that effect divorces. A husband does not divorce his wife, nor does a wife divorce her husband. They file papers in a court system, and it is a court that terminates a marriage. One might have thought, okay, let a Beit Din terminate a marriage. By and large, that's not the way it works. Rather, a Beit Din is there in a supervisory capacity to enable the husband to deliver a get to a wife. The same way marriage is husband gives ring to wife, husband gives get to wife, or shaliach, etc. And that's really our problem. Meaning, even if you had a halachically perfect system, the most a Beit Din can do is order a husband to give a get and then use compulsion if necessary, but the court does not directly dissolve the marriage. As a result, we have situations where husbands withhold gittin from their wives, even if, as in the United States, there is a civil divorce. In Israel, of course, there's no such thing. And why do husbands do so? Well, a lot of reasons. Sometimes they genuinely want a reconciliation, although that's pretty rare. Other times, it is a bargaining chip for things like property, custody, etc. Other times, it is pure malice and spite. There is not even a reason. In other words, sometimes it's an attempt to extort. Sometimes it is just an attempt to inflict emotional pain. So there's all sorts of reasons why people withhold gittin. Of course, If I would be a greater rabbi, I could use Rabbi Akiva Eger's tool to deal with aguna. The story goes, he once called a recalcitrant husband into his study, and he said, "Did you ever learn Mishnayos? You ever learn Mishnah?" He says, "Yeah." "Do you remember the first Mishnah in Kiddushin?" "Yeah." And the Mishnah says, a woman can be free of a marriage by either a get or the death of her husband. Rabbi Akiva Eger says, "I'm giving you your choice now. Pick it." And the man was very offended at what he perceived was a threat. He stormed out of the house. He tripped on a root of a tree. He banged his head against a rock and he died. So that was Rabbi Akiva Eger's divine solution to the aguna. But as I say, most of us don't have that particular power, as it were. Now, let me point out that the phenomena of aguna, right, there are really two types of agunot, really. One type of aguna, which is actually discussed more often in halachic literature, is not relevant for us today, although it's highly relevant in the state of Israel, and that is missing in action husbands. We have, of course, all the different people that were kidnapped and held hostage for many years, victims of the World Trade Center, etc. In the aftermath of the Holocaust, there were many avunot. And those are extremely difficult halachic questions because halacha does not have a presumption of death by absence for X number of years. We have to have some type of evidence, and the rules of evidence are greatly relaxed, but they still must exist. Right, so those are difficult, difficult issues of agunot, and they deserve a treatment of their own. We're not talking about that tonight. Tonight, we're talking about a type 2 aguna where the husband is very much around. We know exactly where he is, but he is refusing to give a get for various reasons. Now, when you get to a type 2 aguna, theoretically, just as a woman can be an aguna and unable to marry without a get, theoretically, men can be agunim, if that's the correct word, as well, and the reason is the following. Under original Torah law and even Talmudic rabbinic law, a man could not be an agun, because if he wanted to marry another wife, he was perfectly free to do so. But at least for Ashkenazic Jews, we have the ban of Rabbeinu Gershom, which prohibits polygamy. So essentially, the same way that if a woman doesn't get a get, she cannot marry, if a man wants to give a get, but the woman refuses to receive it, at least initially, he is not permitted to marry as well. And indeed, there are men. There are men. It's a small number. I'm not going to at all claim there's an equality of problem here. But there is a small group of men that actually find themselves in that predicament. But for a number of reasons, I think it is fair to talk about this as women suffering much more than men for a number of reasons. Numerically, that's obviously the case. But moreover, a man has certain recourses that a woman does not have. For example, since the problem of a man remarrying is only the ban of Rabbeinu Gershom, according to the halacha, the ban of Rabbeinu Gershom may be lifted by what is called a heter mea rabbanim, 100 rabbis, authorizing, permitting him to effectively engage in polygamy, halachically. So the man has that option. A woman, however, without a get, is considered to be married under Torah law, and as a result, would be adulterous, right? So man has heter mea rabbanim, woman doesn't. Moreover, even if a man, in violation of the ban of Rabbeinu Gershom, marries another woman, the children that he has from that improper marriage do not have the taint or the stigma of mamzer. By contrast, if a woman were to live with another man, another Jewish man, without a get, then God forbid, it is not only the sin of adultery, but there is the great, great stigma and difficulty of mamzerut, which is a very, very serious halachic problem in terms of not being allowed to enter Kahal Hashem. Mamzer is severely limited in whom the mamzer can marry, only another mamzeret or giyorit, etc. So because of these different reasons, I think it is fair. I understand someone can argue, you can tell me about your cousin in Cincinnati, you know, a man who didn't get a get, and I acknowledge indeed, there are such problems, but they are less significant overall than the problem of the woman. Now, let me explain something here, which is really the crux of everything. There's really, and I'm sure you're familiar with this in broad terms, and the nature of our problem with get is the following. We have in the law of get two contradictory principles, and it is how you reconcile the contradiction between the principles that is the key to everything that you want to get. Principle number one is a get must be given voluntarily. In other words, there is actually a halacha that says if a person is coerced or pressured into giving a get, the get is invalid. An invalid get does nobody any good. An invalid get means the woman is married. If she lives with another man, it is adultery. If she has a child, it's a mamzer. The fact that she got a piece of paper or a piece of parchment, if the get is invalid, it is no good. That is principle one. Get mu'useh, that is called. A coerced get is invalid. That's principle number one. Principle number two, however, which is almost like matter and antimatter, is that a Beit Din, a Jewish rabbinic court, and Baruch Hashem in Eretz Yisrael, the Beit Din is not just a voluntary or religious institution. It is part of the legal system, particularly in family law, of the state of Israel. So a Beit Din in Eretz Yisrael in matters of divorce theoretically has much more legal power. A Beit Din can force a husband to give a get, and according to Talmudic law, even if it involved beating or cattle prods, like those fellows in New York, I'll talk about that. And a man can be forced until he says, Chotzeh Ani. And people will always bring up, hey, Kofen Asot Yom Ratzon, why can't we hire goons? Why can't we, when we get the rabbis there to beat people up, etc.? Now, Maimonides, the Rambam, already says, well, wait a second here. What on earth is going on? On one hand, you're telling me a get has to be the product of consent. On the other hand, you're telling me I can put a gun to a person's head and I can say, give the get or I'll shoot. So the answer is, well, yeah, but he has to say, I want to give the get. But that's fake. Somebody who says, I want to give the get because he knows otherwise his genitals are going to have a cattle prod or he's going to have a gun, a bullet through his head, that's not consent. So Maimonides gives an answer, which is surprising for a halakhic code, because halakhic codes normally don't speak. It's almost a Hasidic thought that the Rambam articulates. That is, the Rambam says, every Jew in the inner recesses of their soul, right, as Hasidus would later call it, the Pintaliyit, every Jew in the inner recesses of their soul wants to keep God's will. Elamai, the Yetzer Hara is appealing to his egotism, his selfishness, his streak of cruelty. So when I put the gun to his head and I say, give the get or I'll shoot, the Yetzer Hara to rebel against his inner will is less compelling at this point because it's more attractive not to give in. So when he says yes, he's not saying yes because of the gun. He's saying yes because it's his inner ratzon b'pnimiyut to comply with Hashem's will. Well, this is a beautiful thought, and again, this is the halacha, but here is the thing you need to know. Given the fact that a coerced get is invalid, and it is only when a Beit Din has directed that he be forced to give a get, we then say coercion is permitted. It's very important to know that once a Beit Din has ordered a man to give a get, then you can use the cattle prods and various other sanctions. But if you do the same pressure without a Beit Din ordering a get, the get is possible. So if you were to simply ask me a question, if a man is beaten and gives a get as a result of his beating, is it valid or not valid? B'di'evet. Answer, it all depends on whether a Beit Din has made a decision that he's obligated to give a get. So step one, we have to ask our question. When will a Beit Din order a man to give a get? A woman files a tick, a woman opens a tick, etc. Because a Beit Din might advise it, they might say it's a good idea, they might urge the parties to do it, or they may not. But when will they order it? Because that's the key. Now, in the state of Israel, under the Dinei Mishpacha, if a Beit Din orders a man to give a get, under the secular law of the Knesset, many, many sanctions can follow. That's not true in the United States. A person can go to jail for not giving a get. Of course, even that's not a global solution because a lot of the people who make their wives like, who knows, are already in jail. It doesn't always work, but at least, imprisonment. Revocation of passport. Revocation of driver's license. Right? One. Now, theoretically, halacha would allow beating. Knesset does not allow that, as it were. In fact, Rav Goldenberg, who was a great Dayan, who was nifter a short while ago, actually advocated that the Knesset ought to pass a law allowing beating or flogging for people already in prison, as it were. Halacha would allow it. But the portal to allow all of those pressures is the Beit Din must have a finding that he is obligated to give a get. Yeah.
Sorry. If the Beit Din says that he's obligated to give a get,
yeah.
But they don't say beat him.
Yes.
But you go on the side and get people to beat him.
That's a very excellent question. I actually addressed that. It seems to me, based on the Rambam's logic, that the Beit Din does not have to explicitly authorize coercion. It is the issuance of the order that will then allow the parties to engage in coercion. The coercion does not have to be directly connected to the Beit Din. It's a very good point. It's a subtle point, but I believe you're correct in your assertion. So here is the thing. If halacha would have followed the view of the Rambam, the power of the Beit Din would be enormously enhanced. And at least in Israel, many, many agunot would be freed by virtue of the Rambam's opinion alone. What is the Rambam's opinion? The Rambam's opinion is that if a woman goes to a Beit Din and all she says is Mo'is Alai, I can't stand the guy anymore, I want out, Rambam says Beit Din will issue an order that the man must give a get, and all of the coercion could then follow. Now again, they don't dissolve the marriage, I still want to emphasize, they don't, but they could coerce. And the Rambam's language, which I think many modern women would appreciate, is, although the Rambam has other language modern women wouldn't appreciate, but this language they would, and the Rambam says, Eino kishvuya, she is not like a captive slave woman, shetibael l'chol mi sheyirtze, that she has to have relations to anybody who wants her. This is called Mo'is Alai in Halacha. Now, if that would be the case, then basically a woman would be entitled to an order of kafiyah anytime she wants out. Problem is, and again, I cannot change the system, problem is that the Rambam's view has been rejected by all halachic authorities, and this includes Rav Yosef Karo, who almost never rejects the Rambam's view. There is a Karo paskins like the Rambam 9 out of 10 times. This is rejected. Ramah rejects it. All Achronim do reject it. And this is based on the enormous, enormous influence of Rabbeinu Tam, the grandson of Rashi. And Rabbeinu Tam says it is inconceivable that a taina, that a claim of Mo'is Alai, would be sufficient to order a man to give a get, because he says, Shema, based on different Gemaras, Shema einaha natna biacher. Perhaps she just wants to live with another guy, and that is not a justification to terminate a marriage. So, if you don't go, by the way, Rabbi Riskin, many of you know Rabbi Shlomo Riskin in Efrat, if you read, Rabbi Riskin wrote a book in Aguna, that was his doctoral thesis. And although at the end of the book he brings up a prenuptial agreement, but if you actually read the book as opposed to the appendix, he was trying to make a fairly valiant argument that the Batei Din ought to go back to the Rambam's view. But he knows that that's not going to happen, so at the very end he turns to another avenue. But the Rambam theoretically would be a great avenue of promise, but I'm not going to hold that out as realistic, because once again, we have to understand that no Beit Din today can go against the Psakim of the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah. That would not be conceivable, so I'm going to leave it. However, so let's assume we don't go like the Ramah, but this is an important point. The Tshuva Tarash says that even if we reject the Rambam's view that Mo'is Alai alone is sufficient to obtain an order of kafiyah, when a woman has what's called an amatla, now an amatla means she could give reasonable, credible substantiation to why her life with her husband is intolerable, that indeed is a basis for an order of kafiyah, and this would include things like certainly physical abuse, it would certainly include very severe emotional abuse, non-support, all sorts of things like that. So here is one of the problems we have in the system of Batei Din. It's been estimated that of all of the divorce cases that are filed in the state of Israel, only 1% of them, of women, obtain orders of kafiyah. Meaning to say, if a woman thinks she will get an order in a Beit Din, see, once again, once the Beit Din issues the order, a lot of things can happen. Husband can go to jail, he loses his passport, he can lose his job, right? So there are, unlike the United States, the way the system works in Israel, theoretically, once she gets that gold Beit Din order, a lot of things can happen for her benefit. Problem is, it's extremely difficult in the Beit Din system to obtain those orders. One of the things people like Rachel Edmore, I understand, will be coming here, other people are working on. Now again, it's a very delicate thing. You know, when we say we want to, you know, retrain the Dayanim, one has to be very careful here. As Orthodox halachically committed people, We can't just tell them throughout halacha. But I think it is fair to say that sometimes dayanim are not always sensitive to issues of emotional pain, sometimes not even to physical abuse. And I would venture to say that, although I have not examined every case filed in the baked-in system, I would venture to say that more than 1% of the cases ought to be getting kfiya orders. Now again, I'm not going to say we can go back to the Rambam. That's not going to happen. But I think within the Tshuvot HaRash, who develops the concept of amakla, that amakla is reasonable, credible substantiation, there ought to be some kofin orders. And again, even a kofin order is not a panacea, because a guy can go to jail and that's all, but at least there's a lot of pressures within the system.
Excuse me. So you spoke about grounds, basically. That's
yes.
What we would say. It.
Yes.
If a husband is the one initiating this whole process, does he need to provide any grounds at all?
Well, yes. Yeah, as a matter of fact, he does. Because once again, even though under Torah law, a husband could divorce his wife without her consent, but one of the aspects of the ban of Rabbeinu Gershom is not only a polygamy rule, but also a rule that a woman cannot be divorced without her consent. So essentially, if a woman refuses a divorce, he would have to go through the same process. I mean, the grounds would be different, but there would have to be some type of showing. He could not, the Beit Din will not, unless he gets a Heter Meir Rabbanim, the Beit Din will not tell him he can give a get to her without her consent. So there are going to be grounds in those ways.
Rabbi, the statistics of this 1%, is that for all divorce cases or just divorce cases where the husband is hesitant to give the get?
As I understood the statistic, again, maybe I read it in a footnote in a paper, it seems to be 1% of the cases where a woman is petitioning the Beit Din to compel her husband to give a get, 99 out of 100 do not culminate in that particular order.
Why is the bacon, why are the rabbinim and the dayanim so against giving it? What reason?
Well, okay, part of it is a few things. Part of it is that, and this is also even a question of money, of financial resources. A lot of times, grounds depend on a he said, she said type of scenario. Mm-hmm. And the Beit Din has an extreme reluctance to make a definitive finding. As to, for example, abandonment is a very good example. A husband moves out of a house, whatever it is. Now that is grounds to get a get, that he abandoned you. But what if the husband says, I left the house because she was making my life so miserable, etc. So then the Beit Din has to kind of determine who is at fault in that particular decision. And what happens is maybe because they don't have the money to investigate, they don't have the resources to evaluate. So essentially the Beit Din often throws up its hands, and you'll commonly see language like, we don't know, you know, who's responsible for this, so we can't decide. And therefore, we cannot issue an order, because if we're wrong, it would be a coerced debt, and would be invalid. So as a result, you'll see something which is milquetoast, lukewarm, saying, we feel that this marriage ought to be terminated, kind of an advisory thing, but if they don't use the magic words, obligated, the portal of coercion does not open. Now, as I said, there are reforms that within the Beit Din system that might address this. More money for investigators, social workers, psychologists, and the like. Maybe training for the rabbis themselves to understand emotional abuse issues, because emotional abuse is a bit sometimes foreign to the traditional rabbinic outlook, because you know they don't necessarily see that and the like. These are not changes in halacha. Again, I want to emphasize that we're not talking about changing halacha. We're talking about applying halacha by being aware of the psychological dimensions of these issues. Okay? So can we hope? Can the Beit Din be our salvation here? To a little extent. But as I say, I wouldn't pin all of our hopes on that. Even if we get the 1% up to 5%, 10%, 20%, you know, you're still going to have, I think it's fair to say, that the vast majority of cases are still not going to result. The grounds are fairly narrow, either event, and unless you go back to the Rambam, which isn't going to happen, there may be women that are going to be stranded in various ways. Now, let me mention, yes?
Why was this halacha made in the first place?
Which halacha are you referring to?
Of women not having the power to, and only the man have it.
Well, no,
I understand there's a law in the Torah, but there must have been a rabbinic explanation of it.
Well, it's hard to understand. I cannot give you a compelling reason. Part of it is, you might regard this as an apologetic reason, but part of it is that since a woman is called the Akeret HaBayit, the foundation of a house, the Torah wanted her commitment to the bayit to be so absolute that it would be comparatively difficult for her to simply pull out, because once again, the easier you make divorce, the more likely it is to be invoked. So the Torah wanted to create a structure where families remain inviolate to whatever degree possible. On one hand, we're not Catholics. On one hand, the Torah recognizes divorce, but it also creates some difficulty. Let me give you a little example of this. I'm going to give you a secular example. In the state of Louisiana, I don't know if they still have this law, when you applied for a marriage license, you could get two types of marriage licenses. You could get a standard marriage license, which would say that divorce is no fault. Whenever you want to end it, you can end it. Or you could get a super-duper marriage license called a covenantal marriage license that says no divorce unless there's adultery. So you can actually choose. You want a stronger marriage or a weaker one. Now, I think it was repealed because it led to a lot of fights before marriage. I mean, let's say husband and bride and groom are going to the registrar, and the wife wants a covenantal marriage, and husband says, well, honey, you know, maybe we'll go for the regular variety. So it creates a certain amount of problems. So I think they dropped it. But it is very true. The easier you make divorce, the higher the divorce rate. So at some level, the Torah wanted the woman to be the one who works on the bayit. Now, I know you may not like that reason, but it is a din in the Torah, though. It's not just a rabbinic law. So if we move away from the Beit Din for a moment, yeah.
No,
no, so that's a good question, but once again, that's what the Rambam says, and we follow the Rambam on that once a Beit Din tells a husband, you have a halachic duty to give it to him. So the Rambam says, and this part of the Rambam we do follow, the husband's inner pnimiyut is to give the get, even if he says no. That's where that comes in. That breaks the paradigm. You get Moseh, and hold it also, actually Omar Rotsani.
You mentioned earlier the idea that it once there's a decision by the Beit Din, that decision stands, and then if a group of people went to apply pressure or beat up the guy, it might actually be valid.
I believe so.
Yeah. So, but my question is, in the modern times, it seems to me that we're encouraging vigilantism. In other words, I'm afraid of groups running around Mea Sharim and Beit Shemesh. So it seems to me like
New York,
as in Tzibor, we should be going the opposite, right? Legalistic taking away his passport or putting him in jail or flogging him in jail is much more effective than saying, all right, guys, after marriage,
I'm glad you brought it up. I do want to make my position clear. I was addressing the theoretical point that if we got a get out of a man by beating him up after it was in order to get, the get would be b'di'evet a valid get. I did not mean to suggest that it would be proper to implement that. You're 100% correct. It is actually improper to do that. Number one, it's a violation of dina malchuta to engage in that type of violence. Number two, it is a chilul Hashem. It's a great desecration of God's name. And number three, it could very easily be abused in other areas as well. So again, I did not mean to endorse that. I just meant to suggest to the question that it wouldn't invalidate the get after the fact. And by the way, I think it's a sign of the tremendous desperation of women who are chained that they felt they have to resort to such an extreme measure. So on one hand, what they did was not right. On the other hand, they were acting out of an extreme sense of helplessness and despair. So you kind of have to have rachmanut, even if at the same time you condemn what they were doing. Yeah.
I would like to make a suggestion that maybe it's not going to be so popular
if
you decide to accept it. Maybe we'll leave all the questions really until we can hear the literature, and then maybe, time for questions.
Okay, I'll be happy to stay as long as people want for questions. I just want to get out a few points. I'm in no particular rush, so I'm happy to stay as long as you want to talk about this. Let me just mention something else. Let's assume there's no Beit Din involved, or the Beit Din issued an order, you ought to give a get, but we're not compelling you to give a get. So I already indicated that coercion under those circumstances would be get Musa and Pasa. But what is coercion? That's an interesting question as well. So certainly putting a gun to somebody's head, beating him, threatening him, that's coercion. But what about rallies? People have rallies, they have signs, they have Facebook pages and everything else. Is that called coercion? What about boycotts? What about denial of synagogue honors? Right? What if, for example, you have a shul, a Beit Knesset, and somebody was told by a Beit Din that he ought to give a get, but they didn't say he has to give a get? Would it be appropriate, I'm throwing this out as a question, for a synagogue to say, well, we're not going to give you an aliyah, we're not going to count you for a minyan, you can't make a smachot in the Beit Knesset. So there is a whole discussion in halacha about how much pressure amounts to coercion and how much pressure is just, no pressure, but not coercion, and sometimes very, very subtle, right? So there might be ways. One case that was a bit infamous, this was around 25 years ago, and one can raise this question. A man in Toronto refused to give a get to his wife. So all of his wife's friends did not go, refused to go to the mikveh until he gave a get, and the get was forthcoming within 2 days. But I have to say that number one, given the fact that the other husbands were not sinners themselves, they were not doing anything wrong, I would not recommend that as a halakhically permissible solution. It happened to work, but it's not really proper within a marriage for a woman to put that on her husband because of what somebody else is doing. I will also tell you this, in my own pastoral experience, and I've worked with women that have been on note, I often find that pressure and humiliation is not the best way, because often people get more defensive in their positions, they get more resentful, and they convince themselves of their own righteousness. Psychologically, what you sometimes have to do, and this may be very, it sticks in your craw, is you got to talk to the husband and say what a great guy he is. So, you know, your wife really wronged you a lot, and you know she doesn't deserve it, but you're better than that, and you can do the right thing. Because sometimes it happens that if a person feels that he's heard, that his feelings are legitimated, that somebody sees his side of the story, sometimes he's willing to respond in a good way. And again, I know that our instinct is somebody doing a bad thing, you know, let's get him. But the truth of the matter is, the let's get him is in fact not always the best response. Sometimes you need to appeal to the male ego, and the guy feels he's upsetting, you know, and he's been wronged, but he is the righteous person who will be ma'avir al midotav. That can paradoxically sometimes work much better. So it's a kind of like quiet diplomacy can often be a better route. Now, there have been many solutions outside of the Beit Din system that people have tried to employ over the years. I don't know if I have time to go over all of them. Sometimes there's a solution that doesn't work in that many cases, particularly in Israel. It almost never works. But in America, we can sometimes show that the first marriage was halachically invalid. Remember, you only need a get if there's a halachic marriage. Some marriages might turn out to have been halachically invalid because the witnesses were puzzled and the like, etc. In fact, in one of the most infamous cases in the Israeli Beit Din system, you may remember the Ach V'Achot, the Langer story, which propelled Chief Rabbi Shlomo Goren, and got Chief Rabbi Goren the Chief Rabbinate. It also got him much, much criticism, but this involved a woman that was married to a Ger Tzedek, and then she separated without a get, and she married a second guy, and she had a son and a daughter, and the local rabbanut, in Ashdod, proclaimed them to be mamzerim because they were born from the second marriage, and Rav Goren said that he felt that the first marriage was not valid because the geirut was not valid, which is pretty amazing, because at the time, Rabbi Goren was criticized by Charedim for invalidating conversions. How can you invalidate conversions? 40 years later, they invalidate conversions with almost the same methodology. Okay, Okay, but putting that aside, so sometimes we can invalidate marriage. But again, in Eretz Yisrael, it's very difficult to do so because any marriage in Eretz Yisrael was under the Rabbanut, and they were kosher and everything else, so that's not going to work. Another approach that is sometimes used and sometimes abused is Mekach Ta'ut. Mekach Ta'ut would correspond to what in the secular world is called annulment. We can find that the marriage was contracted by fraud or misrepresentation. Now, if a marriage was contracted by fraud or misrepresentation, it was an invalid marriage to begin with, and you don't need it again. Now, Rav Moshe Feinstein had an extreme example where a woman married a man who was a closet homosexual. So Rabbi Feinstein postulates that such a woman did not need a get because it's a basic assumption of a marriage of a man and a woman that there's going to be a heterosexual relationship. Now, Mekach Ta'ut can be utilized in some cases, but in a way, it's a minefield for the unwary because the halacha is the following. If there was a Mekach Ta'ut, but a woman continued to cohabit with her husband after she became aware of the problem, that might be considered a waiver of the misrepresentation. Now consider this. A woman goes to a Beit Din or to a rabbi and says to the rabbi, my husband is a cocaine addict. I didn't know. The rabbi says to her, well, stay with him for a little while longer. Maybe he'll get better. That very fact may take away her ability to, an attempt at shalom bayit, even if it's reasonable, may take away the Mekach Ta'ut argument. So that really puts her between a rock and a hard place. Should she go forward with some reconciliation at the risk of forfeiting the Mekach Ta'ut claim? Or should she press the Mekach Ta'ut claim and to get it without needing a get? Now, if she gets a get, that's fine, but if she feels there's a potential Abunah problem, moving forward with Shalom Bayit can be very, very precarious. Now, here I have to mention that the Mekach Ta'ut argument has been extremely abused in some circles. Again, this is associated with late Rabbi Rachman, who again was a person who was a very caring person, and I'm going to say that he was certainly motivated out of a great, deep sense of Avat Yisrael, so I'm not here to attack him. But Rabbi Rachman did take the Mekach Ta'ut concept to a great, great extreme. In its classical incarnation, Mekach Ta'ut means there was some fraud or deception at the beginning of the marriage. Now, if things happen later, let's say, for example, if somebody was a hidden drug addict at the time they married the woman, that could be Mekach Ta'ut. If somebody became a drug addict 20 years later, that's not a ta'ut. That might be grounds for divorce, but you need a get. Rabbi Rachman tried to develop the theory. You might call it seeds. Whatever happens later must have been attributable to a personality flaw at the very beginning. And had the woman known she would marry a guy that would become a drug addict 20 years later, she never would have agreed. And as a result, he was able to invoke Mekach Ta'ut in virtually every case of Abuna. He had a global solution. The problem with his global solution is nobody else accepted. Now, you have to understand that this is not a kindness, necessarily, because to create annulments that are not recognized by the vast majority of the Orthodox world is essentially generating mamzerim, generating kids who will not be able to marry later. So you can't be a long ranger. You know, when it comes to, for example, someone asks me a shaila about kashrut or about Shabbat. So if one is halakhically responsible, one can give leniencies, one can give loopholes, one can give different ways out. When it comes to the question of gittin and annulments, you cannot be, a rabbi cannot be a long ranger here. Because if a rabbi is a long ranger, that's going to affect the ability of future generations to intersect with the rest of Klal Yisrael. So the Rachman annulment, I believe that the various Batei Din that operated under the Rachman annulment program martyred something like 500 women without requiring a get based on this Mekach Ta'ut problem. But those 500 women were deemed halakhically married by virtually all other Orthodox rabbis in the world. So, Mekach Toed is a real concept, to be sure, but as I say, you have to use it for pre-existing. Since he's medical material, right? It's a pre-existing condition problem. It is not based on things that develop later. Now, the most promising avenue that people are exploring, or not just exploring, but people are using, is, of course, a variety of prenuptial agreements. Heskem nishuin, prenuptial agreements. And let me talk about that a little bit, because there are a lot of varieties of prenuptial agreements, English, Hebrew, American prenups, the RCA, Israeli prenups. And let me first give an example of a prenup that nobody uses, but you might think it might be the simplest of all. But nobody uses it, and there's a reason why. What about a direct promise that if we are separated for 6 months, I, husband, promise, I am machayev myself to give a get, a direct commitment to give a get, which would then be enforceable by a civil or religious court, etc., because you made a promise. What would be wrong with a simple get promise? So the Ramah says the following. It would not be valid. The Ramah calls this self-imposed coercion, meaning to say the following. If I commit myself to give a get, and I say if I don't give a get, I'll pay $10,000, that would be the get promise. Well, if when a woman demands a get, I give it, I don't need the agreement. If I don't want to give a get, but I give it to avoid the fine or the penalty I imposed on myself, but at the time that I'm doing it to avoid the penalty, the Ramah characterizes that as a get mu'usah because of ones d'nafshei, because of the self-imposed duress, so the get is possible over there. So a simple get covenant is not the theory of the prenups. None of the prenups work with a get covenant because of this ruling of Ramah. But the theory of the prenup is following. The theory of the prenup is based on a tshuva of the Rivash. The Rivash of Yitzhak Bar Sheshet was one of the great poskim before the Shulchan Aruch. He was in Mallorca in Spain, and he's considered to be a very, very authoritative tshuva. And this was the concept of the Rivash. An interesting case. A man who refused to divorce his wife was imprisoned in a Majorcan prison for a crime. He was not in prison because he didn't give a get. He was in prison because he evaded his taxes. The family of the woman went over to him and said, if you will write out a get, or authorize a get right now, we will get you out of prison by bribery or whatever it is. So he agreed to the get in order to get out of prison. He then argued, hey, since if I didn't give a get, I would remain in prison. So I gave a get to get out of prison. His argument was, it's a get mu'useh. Of course, that's being very ungrateful to the people who got out of prison, but he argued, he said, get mu'useh, I did it out of coercion, therefore the get is pasul. This was his argument. The Rivash paskens, it is not a get mu'useh. A get mu'useh is only when the coercion is to force you to give a get. But if giving a get is a way to get you out of a situation that you were in, not because of it, then, in effect, the get is extricating you from a negative pressure, but the pressure itself is not because of the get. Does everyone understand the idea? A similar case happened in Baltimore. I'm actually familiar with this case. Maybe every other might remember it. This was a man who, unfortunately, did not give a get to his wife for many, many years, almost 20 years. And he wanted to attend a wedding of a child. He moved out of that state. And the Heinemann, a great pastor in Baltimore, advised the wife that since this man was behind on child support, arrears, and he could be arrested for not paying his child support, he actually be arrested at his daughter's wedding, and then she could go and say, if you give a get, I'll drop the charges. that would be exactly the reverse, because he's not being imprisoned because of the get, he's being imprisoned because of non-payment of child support. And the story goes, I wasn't there, but the story, as I remember hearing it, was he was actually arrested under the chuppah, maybe right before the chuppah. But, strangely enough, and you see the righteousness of women here, a day later, the wife dropped charges without a get. She says, I could not bear to see him in prison. Yeah, amazingly enough. But that would be an example. Now, so the theory of the prenup, and I'm going to go to one of them in a little more detail, is that coercion and pressure can be allowed, even without a baked in order, as long as it does not emanate as a punishment for not giving a get. So, the agreement I want to discuss with you is one that's very popular, because it's both in Hebrew and in English, so it's accessible to Americans who may not speak Hebrew that well. Of course, I'm sure nobody in Malatamim has that problem, but some of us Americans are not as fluent in Hebrew. It also has the endorsement of the National Conference of Young Israel Rabbis. So it was vetted by many, many halakhic authorities, and it's associated with Rachel Lovemore, who's really done a lot of work in this area. In fact, now she's actually on the committee to appoint Dayanim. It's very, very kind of a new situation. And basically, the theory behind the agreement, which has the Haskama of Shlomo Amar, the Rishon Lezion, and Rosalman Nechemia Goldberg, who's a Shlomo Zalman of Astonoma, a very, very eminent pose. And really, in some ways, you know, the truth of the matter is, the concept of the so-called Lebanon Agreement has actually been followed by some Bateitin over many, many years. But this kind of makes it more concrete. And here is the concept. One of the obligations of a husband to a wife when they get married is an obligation of marital support. How that works with Kollel is an interesting question. I'm putting that question aside. In the Ketubah, which every Jewish marriage must have, ana aflach v'yoker v'yezon. I, as a husband, shall work and support and honor my wife as well. And many opinions consider this d'oraita she'era k'suta v'onata. Food, clothing, living, right? That has to be there. So this is an obligation of the Ketubah. But the Ketubah itself does not quantify that obligation. It doesn't say X number of dollars. But in theory, the Gemara tells us, the parties could enter into a prenuptial agreement that will actually assign a shekel or dollar value for support when we're not living under the same roof. And that simply becomes the support obligation as quantified. The Ketubah does not quantify it, but you can have a separate agreement that quantifies. Now, if a man were to give a get in order to say, I don't want to support my wife anymore, that wouldn't be coercion. That would simply be giving a get to get out of an obligation that is not related to get, it's related to marriage. So what the Lebanon Agreement basically does is, it basically says, listen, I'm not going to force you to give a get. You know, you can do whatever you want. You can give a get, don't give a get, I don't care, so to speak. But we enter into an agreement before the marriage that says that for every day that we are separate, we are not living under a common roof, you as a husband agree to pay, and again, the particular amounts, which are not important, it can be whatever you want, but in the agreement it says, you will agree to pay the equivalent of $1,500 a month, or the greater of $1,500 a month converted into shkolim, or 50% of your net income in support payments. And these support payments shall remain in effect until the marriage is halachically terminated by a get, or until the woman refuses to receive a get. In other words, when you're willing to give it. Now, you see what that's doing. Again, I hope you understand the concept of the agreement. If a man gives a get because otherwise, you know, his support payments are going up every month, $1,500, technically, based on the ribush, you know, the ribush is important here, that's not a get melusa, because he's not being punished. We're not saying, if you don't give a get, we're going to punish you. Rather, it simply says, until I give a get, I'm obligated to support my wife. And this is simply a quantification of support. And if it's a quantification of support, giving a get to terminate a support obligation is not a get in ERISA at all. Now, the agreement is a bit more complicated. I think Rachel will be here to talk to you about it, because the agreement does provide for a stopping of the obligation when there is marital therapy, or it's just kind of like a pause in the action, meaning to say it will not remain in effect while we are actively seeking therapy or reconciliation, because otherwise the husband would have no incentive to seek therapy or mediation, because his bill will keep on accruing. So there is a timeout clause to facilitate that, but at the end of the day, there are time limits. It's 180 days, which could be extended by 90 days, but if after 6, 7, 8, or 9 months there is no progress, the woman can basically say to the husband, you owe me $1,500 a month, or 50% of your income, which you can stop by giving a debt. You can decide. No base in here, you don't have to be ordered. Right? This is the concept of the agreement, and the concept is it's based on the rebuttal. Is there a halachic problem with the Lovemore agreement? There might be, and again, you'll always find people that will identify problems, and that is the following. It is critical that the dollar figure or the shekel figure that is chosen be based on a woman's support needs. Because if you were to say, for example, you will pay me $1 million a month, that would clearly be in nature of a fine or a punishment for not giving a get. And that would cross over into get and ma'usa. So it has to be based on the standard of living to which she's accustomed. So that's why it's very important. But that's why the 50%, I think, it's a good number, because in an ideal marriage, you know, the resources are divided. Okay, that's very important. If the number is too high artificially, it turns into punishment. Once it turns into punishment, unless the Beit Din ordered a get, you've got to get ma'usa. But as long as you keep it as support, then you follow the rebuttal analysis. Okay, so that's the basic. I don't have to go over all of the details, but that is the yesod of the prenuptial agreement. And again, as I say, it makes sense. Halakhically, it does make sense, and it has been approved by Gedolim and Pesach Halacha. And the maila is that this would give a woman a mechanism to try to obtain a get without the need to have the portal of the Pesach Beit Din that you're chayav. Now, those who are against it really operate from a different philosophical perspective. They basically say the following. Okay, you can think about this. They say, well, wait a second here. If a husband is not obligated to give a get, then why should we create mechanisms that a woman can obtain a get? Again, that's the whole philosophical orientation, that no woman, according to this definition, no woman is an aguna unless the Beit Din orders she's entitled to a get. But that's an extreme situation. I think the reason why I would reject that is that a Beit Din might feel very, very strongly that a man has an obligation to give a get, but because of lack of evidence and the like, they can't concretize it. And at least this is a mechanism where this could be obtained. Now, there are other prenuptial. There's a Rav Meshulov, who I know from Chicago. His father was a rabbi for many, many years, that has an agreement that is a lot more complicated. The theory of his agreement is that the husband should have a right to withhold the get if his wife does not agree to what is called a reasonable settlement package, and a Beit Din would sit over what is a reasonable settlement package. Many people are against that because different Beit Din will view different things that way. And what the Lovemore agreement says is the following. The Lovemore agreement basically says, let's treat the get separately from everything else. And that is, as long as the man is willing to give a get or the woman is willing to receive a get, they are in compliance, even if they are in total disagreement about everything else, and it delinks, so to speak, it delinks the get from any other issue. The Mishulov agreement, again, we don't have time to fully address it, the Mishulov agreement actually connects the get to all the other issues, and it basically says husband does have the right to withhold the get if a Beit Din feels that the wife is unreasonable in not agreeing to a husband's proposed settlement. Now, he does require the Beit Din to make that determination. That's true. But some people are very uneasy with that idea that the husband could withhold the get based on his unhappiness with other issues. So that's why the National Conference of Oriental Rabbis went with the Levmore Agreement rather than the Mishloach Agreement. But again, according to Halacha, nobody's telling you which agreement to use. Now, in America, the Rabbinical Council of America also has a prenup agreement, which is essentially the Levmore Agreement. They did it first, actually. I mean, they borrowed it from the RCA and modified it. And the RCA, which is the largest group of Orthodox rabbis in the United States, you're probably remember yourself, yeah, they wanted to pass a resolution. I don't think it passed, but it's one of the conventions, that no RCA member rabbi should be allowed to officiate at a wedding unless there is a prenuptial agreement of some sort. Many member rabbis actually opposed this because they felt that a rabbinic organization should not be dictating matters of halachic import, and that each rabbi needs to consult with his own posek for guidance. So I would not be in favor of those types of compulsory membership rules. But still, the concept of some types of prenup probably makes a lot of sense. The thing is, it doesn't have to be a prenup, by the way. In other words, even if you didn't do it at the prenup, you can do it post-nup. I mean, you can sign these agreements anytime during a marriage, and that would work as well. But the final thing I just want to point out is that we get very excited about these things, and certainly if we can help people, it's a very important thing for us. But, you know, at the end of the day, it simply tells the man that if you don't give a get, you're going to accrue financial liabilities. Well, if a man is really bent on malice, so number one, if he's poor, you know, so sue him. All right, you can sue him. Yeah, plenty of people don't pay a lot of things that they owe. And this person may take the same position. If he's rich, well, number one, rich people have ways of hiding assets anyway. But number two, maybe he'll pay for it. You know, there are people who are willing to spend a lot of money just to get out of hurt, you know, just to be able to hurt somebody. So the truth of the matter is, one has to understand that even these great prenuptial agreements, and I do appreciate the work that went into them and the concern that went into them, they're not going to solve the problem. And if you ask me, maybe it's Pollyannish. But the truth of the matter is that the ultimate solution to this problem starts in the attitude that we inculcate in marriage. We started in high school, we started even earlier than high school. Respect for people, kavod habrios, understanding that even if a marriage has to end because of difficulties, you can still end it with metzlichkeit, with consideration. The problem here is a problem of midot, and a problem of character, and a problem of derech eretz. And, you know, as a lawyer myself, I can say that sometimes non-lawyers put a lot of credence in agreements and contracts. They look at them as some magical talisman. But in point of fact, agreements and contracts don't always work when people are not fundamentally decent. And therefore, the ultimate transformation comes in the decency that we raise our children, and not necessarily all of these agreements. So, Baruch Hashem, all of these things can help a little bit. And maybe a lot, well, who knows. But do not expect 100%. And the answer is Hashem. Hopefully, Hashem's work will help have this problem reduced, and we do what we can. But as long as there are people who have b'chiva to do bad things, then bad things can happen. So thank you. I'll be happy to take your questions or comments.
Why can't you go and have, let's say, that after the marriage, the husband runs a get al tnai, yeah, that if in the next 60 years, if a Beit Din goes and lamlitz to give a get, she's mugureshet from the
marriage. Yeah, excellent question. And this, in fact, as I say, the problem about menah has been discussed over many, many years. And your proposal of either giving the woman a get on a condition, meaning you, under the chuppah, you give her a get and say, if I don't give you a get when you demand it 50 years from now, this is your get from Afreya. And that wouldn't make the kids mantelim, because it mostly would mean they're living out of wedlock, so to speak. Yeah, and that was discussed. It was discussed giving a woman a conditional get, or it was even discussed giving a a shaliach of the woman, a get, a whole kind of an extra, or whatever it would be. The poskim discuss it. They do reject it. And the reason they do reject it is based on a principle in the fourth parak of Gittin that says that any get that is delivered to be effective at a later time or to be effective on a condition, which is followed by a cohabitation, that's a critical thing, is considered an annulment of the agency and an annulment of the get. So you do have that problem of the living together after the get may reestablish a marital bond.
Is that Kiddushin or Get
Ochanai?
Well,
they are two different problems, but you have an identical problem. That is, Kiddushin Ochanai followed by Bia is considered to be a waiver of Tanai. A Get Ochanai followed by Bia is called a Bito HaGet. And there is a principle of Bito HaGet, which parallels the Kiddushin Ochanai.
What's the story with that Munah? Because the husband has disappeared. Or may have been killed, and we don't know whether.
Yeah. So that.
How can the base do just something there?
Okay, so that's what I called an Aguna type 1, and that of course wasn't my topic tonight. Basically, a Beit Din can try to do a lot. Again, we don't have this automatic presumption of death, but you may know we lost the great Rav Raji Yosef a month ago, and you may recall or heard that in the Yom Kippur War, where there were many, many husbands who were missing in action, he managed to free over 900 women who otherwise would have been adunot. So, in truth, we work very, very hard.
How did he do it?
Well, the way you do it is, halacha does not require the typical two eyewitnesses, which you're not going to have, but it allows circumstantial evidence, it allows dog tags, it allows documentation, meaning to say you pierce together, you have to work very hard to pierce together circumstantial evidence, which halacha considers admissible. Now, one of the very interesting debates in halacha is what is the status of DNA as a halachic identification of somebody. This really surfaced in the aftermath of 9/11, the World Trade Center, where you often could not identify bodies by anything recognizable, even dental records sometimes, but you could obtain DNA identification. Now, DNA is not a classic halachic identifier. Talmud doesn't mention it, of course. So there are some parties who are very recalcitrant. They said, well, we can't use DNA to mock it out of the nuts. On the other hand, many, many great rabbis did say that the reliability of DNA is very, very established, and as a result, we do allow that. Now, of course, you have to keep in mind to be very careful, because if you find a severed hand and you can identify from the DNA whose hand that was, that's not proof of death. Maybe there's some guy walking around without a hand. So you have to be very careful that partial DNA from fragments of a body would not be definitive under any definition. But on the other hand, if you have DNA from a vital organ, that would support you. So I do want to say that type of aguna has a much larger halachic literature. We have records of rabbis struggling, agonizing over this for literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. So this is something that we do have a tradition of working very hard. The type 2 aguna has been a little more neglected in that sense, and hopefully we're trying to fix that.
I just, unless you said this and I missed it, in terms of the prenuptial agreements, how often have they actually worked in a case of
that? They claim, the National Conference of Initial Rabbis claims that this has been relatively effective. Now, what's hard to know is this is the thing. You don't really have a control group. You know, in scientific testing, you have to have a placebo, right? In other words, we know that the majority of cases where these agreements were signed, which ended in a divorce, the divorce was given. But you know, maybe the guy would have done it anyway. So we don't have a controlled experiment. In fact, you can even argue psychologically that people who are willing to sign prenuptial agreements are less rigid and more flexible, and therefore, it goes back to the old story. Those who signed the agreements probably didn't have to sign them. That's what I'm talking about. So there's no real way to know, In other words, what we need is we need a case where the woman basically said, I'm going to court unless you give a get. And I'm not sure we have statistics on that.
You mentioned earlier that in Israel that only 1% of cases of divorce actually get but this is in Israel, not in America. And you also mentioned that in America that they're more likely to use the concept of invalidating a marriage. In Israel they don't. And before someone asked, you know, how come the Beit Din isn't willing to do these things, you said that it's often an issue of lack of funds or resources. So I'm wondering, how come, are the American Beit Din really that much richer than
the No. Let me clarify something.
Why are you making the difference? Why do they work in America and not in Israel?
Yeah. When I said that, I never said that an American Beit Din is more likely to invalidate a marriage. I mentioned the Rackman Beit Din. The Rackman Beit Din is a small subset. The average American Beit Din does not invalidate a marriage, just like they won't in Israel. So in that sense, they're the same. And I would say also that the Kofin order in America is not the child in Israel. I didn't mean to suggest that. And certainly, if you talk about financial resources, if anything, the Beit Din system in America has less money because it is not governmentally funded. So as a system, I think the Israeli Beit Din system, with all of its inadequacies, is actually structurally superior than the American Beit Din system. The American Beit Din system is the Wild West because most cities don't even have a regular Beit Din. They have an ad hoc Beit Din, where, you know, I choose my rabbi, you choose your rabbi, etc. So I don't see any big difference there. The big difference is only in the negative, and that is, once you get a Kofin order in Eretz Yisrael, you will have a whole bunch of remedies. In America, if you got a Kofin order, because of separation of church and state, there's still nothing that's going to happen other than posting a guy's name or not giving him an aliyah. So in that sense, the legal structure in the state of Israel is superior to the protection of a benot than you have in the United States.
So I was told by the head of ORA that in the U.S. that the issue of, you know, taking a chiyuv get isn't really a big issue, but in Israel it's like, you know, one of the main things that...
Well, yeah, the reason is because in America, whether the Beit Din issues a chiyuv get or not a chiyuv get is not going to make a big difference, because over rallies you can have without the chiyuv get, and anything more than that you're not going to have with the chiyuv get. So in America, those magic words don't accomplish that much. In Eretz Yisrael, they could accomplish a lot, theoretically.
If somebody gets a Beit Din in, I don't know, Omaha, Nebraska, the rabbis in, Portland, Oregon, recognize, is there such a thing that you come out with a get that's ostensibly from an Orthodox Beit Din, and also the Orthodox Beit Din rabbis will say, oh, sorry, those rabbis.
Well, listen, the problem with get is a similar problem to the problem of gayness, which is both a problem in America and a problem in Israel as well. And that is, you know, the Constitution of the United States has something called the Full Faith and Credit Clause that says, you know, if a court in Connecticut said something, it has to be accepted by the courts of New Jersey. That's in the Constitution. Now, halakhically, it's identically the case that, you know, one Beit Din is supposed to abide by the decision of a Beit Din and not relitigate. But in practice, you know, people say, well, that Beit Din is not religious enough, it's not good enough, we don't accept their conversions, we won't accept their getting. Right? It happens. Now, I will say that get is a little better than conversion. And the reason is that get tends to be relatively selective. Not every Beit Din, let's say in Omaha, is going to write a get. They often refer people to major metropolitan areas like Chicago, that have big rabbis. So it's less likely for another Beit Din to say a get is possible than it is to say a conversion is possible. A conversion is done in a much more localized way. But there's no guarantee. There's no guarantee. You know, as I say, we don't have this automatic idea that every get will be accepted and every conversion will be accepted.
Doesn't that make people nervous? The people getting the get?
Well, yeah, but as I say, historically, the get intended to be done by fairly feminine rabbis. The average Orthodox rabbi in America might do a conversion on it, but he will normally not write a get. Right? So I think getting is a bit more specialized, And because of that, there's less of a problem in people attacking it.
Two questions. Is there any chance that the Rabbanut here will go for this concept that we will not marry you until you have a prenup? And wait, let me just give you the second question.
Yeah.
Second question is, you were talking about a prenup, which is milachachila.
Yeah.
But what about all the current other will? What can the community or anybody do? You mentioned that, but you didn't really...
Okay, a few things. Sohar Rabbanut, like, you know, Sohar and Rav Shtalov was, at some point it looked like he might become a Rav Pereshi. Sohar is very, very supportive of either this Levmore or even Mitchell agreement, and, you know, they would, had Rabbi Shtalov become Rav Pereshi, that would have been a possibility. But he didn't, and as a result, that's not going to happen. All I can say is that even if there's no halakhic objection, but nobody in the Rabbanut is pushing it, in an affirmative, aggressive
way.
Nobody's pushing it. It's okay, every individual rav and couple, you know, make their decision, but there is no institutional pressure to use these things. As I say, at some point, if Sohar ever gets in, then you might see a different attitude towards that. In terms of what do you do, 900% correct, obviously prenups only work for people who sign prenups, and even postnups only work for people who sign postnups, which they can do later, that if you have an agunah, the marriage is broken down. Once the husband says, I don't want to give a get, you're not going to be able to get him to sign any type of agreement to that effect. So what do you do then? The truth is, we're very limited. I mean, at that point, you have the issue of the informal pressure, like the boycott, which raises some halakhic problems, or you have the baked-in system. Now, here, once again, as I say, there is a modest amount of tinkering within the baked-in system that may help women and may be based on the choice of Dayanin and the expansion of the Amakla.
That's in Israel.
No, in Israel, yeah. Oh, in America, what you get? Okay, so in Israel, that's what you have. In Israel, you work through the baked-in system. Outside, there's not a lot you can do. You still need the baked-in, but I would say this. One of the things you can do, which may or may not work, but it might work, is if you got synagogues and yeshivot to act in an organized fashion, they could do things like denial of kibbutzim, no aliyot, no participation in smachot. And in fact, even as conservative an organization as Agudat Yisrael of America, which is an American Haredi organization, they did pass a resolution for all their member synagogues, which aren't that many, but they passed a resolution that if any man is in contempt of an order of a Beit Din to give a get, that person should not be allowed to come to synagogue.
The RCA has
I believe the RCA has a similar resolution. I believe they did. I believe they did. Now, one of the problems we have is that there is no cohesiveness, meaning you go to a place like New York or even Baltimore, where you have kind of hard up, Leah and Hara, many, many shuls. So if a husband is not welcome in one place, he'll go across the street to some other place. And there'll be husband's shows and wife shows, etc. So unless you have the cohesiveness and the commitment to work together, none of this is going to work. And of course, if the husband has gone off the derech and he's not an Orthodox Jew anymore, then none of it makes a difference. So, as I said, you know, we can think about different possibilities, but nothing is perfect. And then, of course, I'll mention what I think is the ultimate thing that could work, and that is sit down with the husband and, you know, a kind word, ma'aneh rach, yashiv chema, a soft response can sometimes take away anger, and that is surprisingly effective, and people often don't even think of it that way, so that can often be the straw that breaks the camel's back. Yeah.
Okay. The thing is, throughout Jewish history, rabbis have found, like, you know, very original solutions.
Yeah.
Like back in Talmudic times, people were interested, you know, giving loans, and they you know, had the Crohn's bowl. Rabbeinu Gershon with his polygamy, which the Torah permits. And the whole thing, this whole thing of the get is really based on, if the husband doesn't like the wife, then he will give her a get. That doesn't mean that that's the only way to be divorced, but that's how it's interpreted.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why can't the rabbis get together, and there are, you know, I wouldn't say this, but there are some people who say, Well, the reason that they don't find a good solution is because the rabbis are all men, and the ones who are suffering from this are all women. And why can't the rabbis get together and say, cases of where the husband is refusing to give a get, and the Beit Din decides that it's justified for him to give a get, or recommended for him to give a get, that if the wife can get, say, 100 rabbis to agree, that the Beit Din can issue a get, even if the husband doesn't want. Why can't the rabbis do that when in other situations where it's not the woman suffering, I mean, for example, when it's a man suffering?
I understand the pain and the sense of helplessness and even mm-hmm. feeling that mm-hmm. that looks like a system that is discriminatory, that helps men with their problems and doesn't help women with their problems. I understand the feeling, though.
It's a big
kind of shock. Yeah, the famous statement of Lou Greenberg, which I do not agree with, but you know, when there's a halachic will, there's a rabbinic way, or the other way, rabbinic will is a halachic way, yeah. But the truth of the matter is, things aren't that simple. Meaning, people often say, if we can put a man on the moon, why can't we cure cancer? And the answer is, there are different, each problem has its own unique dynamic. Now, this thing about only a man can give a get, this is not an interpretation of some Rebbe Yashiv or some 20th century rabbi. This does go back to the oral law, to the Talmud, and the Mishnah, and the like. And there are parameters. Now, halacha is not infinitely malleable. When you go to the, you gave an example of an interest-bearing loan, a way that you can lend money with interest. That is based on Talmudic precedent. Meaning that's not something somebody invents later. The Talmud itself gives you that. So we are hard-pressed. Now, do I fully understand, why God or the rabbis of Talmud made the law that way? I'll confess that I can't fully, argue that this is what I would have chosen. But a responsible person has to take the framework.
What I've read, and my interest in this is completely theoretical, and only I don't know personally, fortunately, any of who knows currently. A woman who was not being asked to respect her husband, so she's currently. But that basically, if you look at the laws of marriage in Judaism, even though we say, yes, it's a contract between the two parties, but if we say, what are the conditions, the three ways that, of creating the marriage, is basically the woman is selling her rights to the person, and she is his possession, and she's being treated as a possession, and it shouldn't be that way.
And that's why
it's only the husband, because it's like he's the owner, she's nothing.
Let me just say one thing. Marriage requires mutual consent.
And divorce requires mutual consent.
Meaning theoretically the woman can make, again, the man has certain options, that's true, but the divorce procedure requires mutual consent.
But once she's agreed, it's like, that's it. He is the only one who can release it because she has sold herself as his property, basically.
Well, as I say, it is not he is the only one. Meaning you need mutuality. So if he's not with you, he can hold up the works, only in the sense that you need mutuality. Anything that's mutual means any one party can make a veto.
With 100 rabbis,
I understand. I'm not going to deny that the man has an option, although there are many rabbis who will never validate that. That's another point. Yeah.
In the case of Kriyat Get, and the man gets out of the country and goes to America and goes off to Derech, but we know where he is, what's the solution?
I indicated before that theoretically halacha would allow him to be beaten up
but the guy got indicted.
That's correct.
They got indicted. So
it's against the law. It's a crime.
So he got indicted. So who they going to send to beat him up?
You know,
good enough money?
Well, you can always find a single who will do it. I mean, no question. You know, it's a good question, but again, in a sense, you know, any criminal that escapes a jurisdiction when there's no extradition treaty has gotten off, right? So essentially, you're talking about the equivalent of a criminal who has fled to a jurisdiction that doesn't extradite. By the way, the State Department, at one point, issued a travel advisory to American citizens traveling abroad. This is an amazing thing. It says, if you have not given a Jewish divorce to your wife, do not travel to Israel because you may get your passport. You may get your passport confiscated.
You can't come to Israel because
they'll cancel that. No, that's right. But even before they did it, he was given an advisory. Not to why is the State Department helping men not to get given? It's a good question. But again, I mean, what you're raising is you're raising a good question. But what I'm saying is, this is a question that every legal system faces. A criminal evades the jurisdiction of a state. And he goes to a place where they don't extradite him back. So what are you going to do? You identify an example of that.
Is there any kind of a situation where a court, a Beis Din will say, we are giving this get to the woman, even though...
That was your question. Well, again, that is the fundamental problem here. The fundamental problem on a more structural level is... do not divorce parties. Parties divorce parties. A Beit Din can order, a Beit Din can direct, a Beit Din can encourage. A Beit Din, unless it's Mekach Kalut, cannot declare a marriage.
Can they decide that a person is structurally insane or they're incapable of giving the get and therefore the Beit Din takes responsibility?
You know, that's even going to be worse. In fact, that is a very it's a very rare problem. That actually is a very significant problem when it happens. And that is, when the husband becomes mentally incompetent, no get can be given at all. That's actually a problem. If he's in a coma, that's a very serious problem, which is rare. But from that is one of these 18-year comas. That really is virtually insoluble problem. Halakhically, the Beit Din cannot be his surrogate.
No, but you can have someone psychiatrically unstable but still be.
No, that's correct.
Intelligent.
No. I'm not suggesting every case of mental illness renders him a shelter. Most times, not. A person could be a schizophrenic and still be legally competent. But let's say a person is in a coma or something like that. Now, Rav Moshe, the very first tshuva Rav Moshe wrote in 1920, involved an interesting case. It involved the question of mental incompetence. This was a person who married a woman, and he had the delusion that he was Mashiach. And because he was Mashiach, he thought he brought the world back to Adam HaRishon before the sex. So he didn't wear clothes. He used to go outside as a nudist without clothes, claiming he was back to Gan Eden. So the wife's family demanded that he give a get, but the question was, halachically, is he mentally competent to do so? So Rav Feinstein ruled that since, based on his insane delusion, he's behaving perfectly rationally, based on his assumption, this is rational behavior. He is treated as having a delusion, but he is still mentally competent. So it's tricky. What is a shame? It's very tricky. But all I'm saying is, let's take a case of a coma as an extreme example. There's no way a woman can get a get. That's a rare problem, but a very, very, that's an insoluble problem, actually.
Can I just say something before the next question?
Yeah.
I just want to mention that when we're done, those who are here can help stack the chairs and kind of put them back, so it's not a one-man job. I know that there are other questions. I would want us to take the opportunity to formally thank you and to appreciate excellent presentation. And I'm happy for the questions to continue. I just wanted you to have the opportunity to be appreciated by all of us for coming in.
Do we have a time limit where we can't ask any more questions when we can go?
Well, you can leave whenever you want. I don't want to keep anybody.
I have a two-part question. One, you mentioned Rabbi Rachman gave get to 500 women. I presume of those women, they had children. What is the policy of rabbis when these
I don't have the numbers of children. I can't really go into
that. Let's say even one.
But as far as I know, most rabbis in the modern Orthodox variety would consider them not
married. So they would ask, or I mean, there is a Well, so yes, is that still or not?
Well, one of the things we do ask in the Orthodox rabbis, we don't ask that many questions, but we do ask if a woman was married before, we ask how was the marriage terminated. So that is the one question we do ask. And if a woman tells me it was terminated via an annulment, that would be a big one.
Okay. So listening to you, I'm hearing that you really don't want to have the desecration of Hashem's name.
Yes.
But the first time that I met a mamzer, who was halakhically a mamzer, he went to an Orthodox rabbi in America, and the rabbi didn't ask the question. They put out the invitations. 3 days before the wedding, the rabbi says, "You're a mamzer."
And the rabbi had the information ahead of
time? He didn't ask the question. But then he asked. And 3 days is not enough to go to any Gedolei HaDor to ask what you can do. Since that day, which was a long, long time ago, every single person I see, I think of the pain of that particular person. And when we're talking about a Bul Not, usually when we talk here, and I know women who've been involved in the last X years, and what goes on in the Beis Din is definitely desecration of God's name. That's a different story. But to every single person who's a Naguna, it's a woman. For the Jewish people, it means children are not being born who would have been to Jewish lands. We're losing a big population of people who are righteous, because the ones who will get married, who don't care about, that get married anyway and have the children. And we have these children who are out there who can't get married. And I don't know if you've ever said to somebody, "I'm not going to let you marry somebody." But it's a very, very, very painful thing. And so in Israel now, this is the second part of this question, we have marriages in the Beis Din with the rabbis. Wouldn't it be preferable, given that most people aren't religious, to have civil marriages?
You know, I want to tell you the truth. This was actually a proposal in Morocco. The Morocco rabbinate was a very esteemed Sephardic rabbinate in the 1800s, 19th century. There was actually a proposal to abolish Sidur Kiddushin and replace it with either civil marriage or Pilegish, with financial commitments. This was a rabbinic proposal, because they said, this way we will avoid problem of agreements. So this was a serious proposal that the Moroccan rabbinate wanted to adopt. I think our response would be that Kiddushin is such a sacred institution that it's like, if you have a rat in your house, you're not going to use an atom bomb to kill the rat. Meaning, agunas is a serious tragic problem, but to throw out an institution of marriage because of the problem of Aguna, I think we would be ultimately, the Jewish people would be losing much
now
more.
Now we have tens of thousands of people who probably are amongst them.
I
would think so, because if you're talking about, people in America, all over the world, who have religious weddings, and they don't get kids.
There are not as many as you would think. In other words, even one case of Aguna is a tragedy, and we can't be callous for it. It's 100% true. But if you're just talking about numbers, the numbers are not phenomenally large. There might be at any one point, there might be maybe 100 women who might still be as a
note. No, but I'm talking about generations. I'm looking at these people who then have their children.
Of course, many as a note are beyond childbearing years old.
Older women too. The way I did my calculations is going back.
Yeah.
People, since reform movement where GEP became something different, you end up having people who are mamzering having children,
You identify the problem. All I'm saying is the solution, it would be something very, very drastic that would also greatly hurt Jewish people in numerous ways. So let's get rid of marriage, because if there's halakhic marriage, there's mamzer. Say, throw that out.
rephrase the question a little bit. I was SOAR called me recently to ask for money, and the basis that they're asking for money was that what we do is we encourage secular couples to avoid getting civil marriage and to go through the rabbinate, because that's through Kedushin of Israel. Right. And I said, no. I said, I don't want to give you money for that. And I didn't tell them that. I didn't push them off gently. But my thinking was, is that really the value? If someone anyway is secular enough that they don't want to get married in the rabbinate, they don't want a Kedushin, they don't want a Jewish marriage, why do Christian do it? What are your gains?
Well, you know, this is an interesting question. I think you do gain something, but sometimes SOAR has an overall approach to outreach to people in, and they feel that by making the marriage warm and inviting people, you can then do Shabbat and Kashrut. I mean, in other words, you're correct. If you only look at the issue of getting them married, then maybe you have more of an argument of why create the problem about the marriage. And this is part of an overall embracing them into the whole of Judaism. So I think there is a place. There is a place. No, I did hear from Rav David Cohen, the great rabbi in New York, who actually told Orthodox people that if you're asked to be a witness at a wedding of non-religious people, you should decline. You should let them be puzzle witnesses. But that will allow the invalidation of the marriage. So there is, what you're saying has been articulated by some of them. Yeah. Are getting on tonight, as long as it's not followed by the other. Now, in our customs today, you typically don't do it, sometimes even with war. You know, in 1948, it used to be the practice of the idea, the right nurse, that is, to tell soldiers to give getting to their wives on a tonight. They stopped doing it because it undermines combat morale.
Really?
Individual soldiers do it sometimes. But a soldier has to feel that his wife is waiting for him.
Right.
So they don't do it institutionally anymore. But sure, get off tonight is a lot.
Okay. And my second question is, would you mind please expanding on the halakhic problem of economic boycotts? There's a campaign that's going around now.
Yes. Well, the question is this. Without a psych-based game of the divorce, there's a rule called get moves. Okay? So if I put a gun to somebody's head, I beat him up, get his over. So the question is, what type of coercion is called overwhelming my will? Now, certainly, threats to my physical well-being, certainly, right? Loss of limb, loss of life, the hurt to my children. The question really becomes, and of course, if somebody even takes money from me, if I don't give a debt, that's called coercion. The question is, what is the status of humiliation? What if a person gives a debt because he's been shamed into giving a debt? Some posts can take the position that since shame is equivalent to losing your life, if you're embarrassed, obligated, and rabid, it's kiyulah shofet panim, so we treat shame as a powerful a factor that overwhelms my will as threats to my life, and they would call it a debt musa. Others say shame is psychological, and just because somebody gets to get it, they don't want to be embarrassed, that is still a willing decision. And maybe the best proof to that is how many people are shamed that don't give a debt. So the very fact that it doesn't work a lot of the times indicates that it's not overwhelming pressure.
If the economic pressure isn't directly on the recalcitrant husband, but it's on those who might be able to pressure him into giving a debt, like his father or his uncle, mm-hmm. then might that be an effective means to attempt to, and even though, as the Rev said, with the women in Toronto,
yeah.
where that was ex post facto, questionable, but 2 days later, she had her get, and they went to the mikvah. So,
So if you're asking me, would economic pressure against a third party be a puzzle get? Would the get be puzzle? The answer is probably not. Probably would be a kosher get. But, there is a policy question the Jewish community has to ask itself. I have to find out about this case in a little more detail. I heard about it today. And that is, if no Beit Din has yet been involved, even to say a get is recommended, even if they don't say the magic words, chayav, is it proper for a Jewish community to coerce a get if there has not been the informed judgment of Poskim and Rabbanim that a get is advised? I think it's a very serious problem. Even if it's not a get melusa ex post facto, I'm not in favor automatically of Facebook rallies every time somebody wants a get. There at least needs to be the informed judgment that a get is a proper termination, even if you don't get the magic words, you know, chayim.
If you have a piyut get and a kol kore.
All right, so then I think everything, then all bets are off. Then I'm certainly,
If someone feels he was coerced, he gives a get for however, whatever, however they got it from him, and he feels he was coerced, afterwards he reneges on it, he tracks his get. Is there such a thing?
Sorry, he doesn't give another
tax? He gives a get, because, and then he says, I was a coerced to give this get,
well,
a coerced get.
Well, here,
and I take it back.
Here is the theory. A man cannot take it back. Once it's done, it's done. He can argue, it wasn't, you know, he has no basis. He can argue in front of a basin that the get that I gave was invalid because it was coercion. A basin would then pass on it. But he does not have any per se right to take it back. It's a done deal, unless it was invalid at the time. Same thing with the conversion. The invalidation of conversion is very controversial, but there's no way you can simply say the conversion is no good now. You have to say there was a problem at the very beginning. Same thing with the get.
If a woman, in the case that she said, if a woman gets remarried, and after the husband says, no, the get was not, I was coerced to give the get, what happens to the woman?
So it depends. Now again, just because the husband says something doesn't mean anything per se. But if the husband goes to a basin, a reputable basin, and the basin determines this was a coerced get, then it turns out that her second marriage was an adulterous marriage, which is a non-marriage. And she committed adultery.
And can
the children expect that to be mounted? Yes, they would. Yes, they would. But let me point out the following very basic argument. A get is written in the presence of the basin. So in a sense, unless the basin was ignorant of the facts, if the basin wrote the get, by definition they made a determination it was not coerced. So theoretically, the husband should not be able to go to another basin and make an argument of coercion, because the basin that wrote the get must have passed him as it was valid. So it shouldn't. Now, is this what I'm saying is no issue because basins sometimes, you know, intervene. But if the system works properly, there shouldn't be a second basin that is second guessing what a first basin says.
Who gets to choose the basin? How was the basin compromised in the
present of the beginning? Yeah, well, that's a major issue. It depends. Of course, in Eretz Yisrael, it's based on residence of the parties, yeah, etc., whoever opens the tick. In Chutz La'aretz, basically, the basin should be in the city of the one that is the defendant. So if the woman is suing for divorce, she has to go to the city of the husband. Now, in that city, there may be an established basin, like Muncie has a satellite basin or Lakewood, or there's sometimes an ad hoc basin, which means she picks a rabbi who will send a summons to the husband, who will be directed to choose another rabbi, and the two rabbis choose a third rabbi. And that's called a Zavla basin. Zavla is an abbreviation, Zeh Borer Lo Echad. Each one chooses one.
A question from a different angle. So you are both a lawyer and a halachic expert, and you see, you mentioned that the halachic literature has way more to say about type 1 agunot that you didn't speak about, I assume because that was more common. We now live in a time when type 2 gets a lot of attention. I'm asking for a personal reflection about the fact that the Jewish community is in such a place that this issue even surfaces, and how, as a halachist, you hold that. Do you?
Well, you know, listen, there's no secret that just from plain numbers, the divorce rate in the Jewish and in the Orthodox community has absolutely skyrocketed over the past 20 or 25 years.
But that doesn't have to lead to agunot.
No, it does not have to lead to agunot, but basically the point is, the more requests for divorce, in other words, when there were fewer, let's assume, I'll make up a number, let's assume that 20% of requests for divorce create abnormal situations. But you only had a small number of divorces, you had a small number of remarriages statistically, because it reflects, it tracks in some way the divorce rate as a whole. So if you ask me a very interesting question, is the percentage of abnormal cases relative to divorce cases higher or not, that would be a hard question to answer. In objective numbers, it's higher because divorce cases are higher generally. I would suggest that. I would suggest the following. In Europe, if you go back to the Shekels, the type 1 abnormal and the type 2 abnormal actually overlapped because a lot of the ways women were abandoned were not by husbands getting trapped in 9/11 situations, but by simply moving, by leaving, by disappearing, by going to America. And I would suggest that in European Shekel, community sanctions were sufficiently strong that a person couldn't get away. It was a small town type of situation. Kihilot, there was one shul, one rabbi, etc. When communities are strong and there's consensus and there's solidarity, it's much more difficult to be this recalcitrant guy. We live in a diffuse society. Many shuls, many places, easy mobility. You know, they don't like you in Baltimore, so you go to Silver Spring or whatever it is. So I can certainly understand that the breakdown of community structure and solidarity would increase the ability of people just to be more selfish. You know, the old idea that even with children, you know, it used to be a village raising children. Now it's, you know, we're each family to itself. So I don't think that's the answer.
One of the things that happens here, this is a different direction from that last question, is in the Beis Din, a woman comes up and the guy doesn't want to give her the get, so he says, okay, give him the house, it's basically extortion.
They give it to the bride.
And they sort of, in the courts here, in the civil courts, you write down everything, and the Beis Din, you don't write any, there's no scribe, so it's just all, okay, so people wink, and so that's extortion.
Yes, it is.
Now, doesn't Jewish law have something to be said about extortion? Isn't there a way of removing extortion from the Beis Din? The Beis Din is not complicit in extortion?
Well, listen. I mean, extortion is bad, okay? But a woman not having a get is worse. And sometimes the Beis Din feels it's reached a halakhic dead end. And there's no other way. I mean, listen, if a robber comes into your house, and says, you know, your money or your life, you know, you're going to give him the money, even though it's wrong for him to take your money.
But the robber knows I'm not going to have any money in my house, then he might kill me and do whatever he does, but he's not going to have anything to steal. But so if a recalcitrant husband comes to the Beis Din and knows that coercion will not get him anywhere, it's like the robber coming to that house.
You know, all I can tell you is I think, you know, every situation has its own unique dynamic. I don't think there's no Beis Din in the world that is in favor of these types of extortionate demands. And nobody's going to say this is the right way to proceed. But I think Beis Din might be a vision of the lesser of evils under those circumstances. Now, you're arguing that the variability that to get something through pressure is encouraging that type of behavior. I understand. On the other hand, the Beis Din also has to look at the case in front of it, meaning the following. If we were to follow your method, maybe in the long run, maybe abnormalities might be reduced. But in the short run, there are going to be a number of women who will not be able to get their get. Right? So that's always the question. Do I kind of look at the immediate situation? It's very similar, by the way, just to draw an analogy totally far afield, to something like Gilad Shalit, the prisoner exchange. We have this guy, this unfortunate person, who is held hostage. His life is in danger every single moment. And we have a way of extricating him from his predicament, but only at the expense of releasing 1,000 terrorists into the general society who may kill X number. Now, we could say, we're not going to do that, which means let him get killed. So in a sense, it's always the short-term immediate problem versus being strong and that we granted it in order to prevent those abuses.
Except for the difference here, not in the States, but here in Israel, is that we have civil courts and we have the religious courts. So the civil courts can deal with all these if they.
They can't deal with the get. I understand.
But they do.
With the get, what do they do?
Women who don't get, who are told by the Beis Din 150 times, shalom bayis, go back home, and finally get very, you know, this is enough.
Yeah.
Go to a lawyer. Go to a court.
Yeah.
Not a Beis Din.
I understand, but what does the court give? The court
takes his salary, takes his money, they take his this, they take his that. The guy gives a get.
Oh, okay. In other words, in return for getting something back. In other words, the court does not order him to give a get.
The court can order him to give, but they take away from him everything.
The courts.
So what is the incentive for him to give a get? Because he'll get some of it back if he gives a get.
Yeah.
I can call that extortion too.
Yeah.
I mean, that's also an extortion.
I'm
not necessarily against that approach. That's a way of giving her certain leverage that you gotta get.
Opinion on external refugees that are outside the framework of the Rabbanut. The case that I heard of that I was interested in was there was a woman who, morning after the wedding, the husband fled to America. Demanded 40,000 shekel for the get. It was clear that this was, you know, some kind of plan. It wasn't that he planned to be married to forever and then.
He married for the purpose.
Yeah, the day after the wedding.
Married for the purpose of getting
married. Yeah, the day after the wedding, he went because he knows, you know, you're allowed to extort money in the Israeli court. So he, from the Beit Din. So he, you know, left to America. Said, I want 40,000 shekel.
Yep.
This woman went to court in Israel, and the Rabbanut said, you know what? You should pay him 40,000 shekel. We can't do anything. And so at the same time, Bakta Kahana Dror of Mavoisatum wanted to try to set a precedent here. Yeah. She organized a herkev of three dayanim, one who was from the Beit Din in a private Beit Din that was from the, what's it called? The Haredi Beit Din, that is not part of the Rabbanut. Yeah, from the Eid HaHaredit, and a Rav Bigman from Mali Bagua, and another Rav, I don't remember who it was, made this herkev, and they said that it was, two of the Rabbanim said that it was Mektu, but they didn't, you know, go there. The one they actually went by was this, the Rav from Meisharim said that the man had converted, like, as a child, and he said, well, because he was converted by the state, I don't accept the state conversion.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Therefore, so it was very problematic in the but the so in the end, what happened was it's still some of it's up in the air. The Rabbanut had the they took funds of these 40,000 shekel, which comes from Keren Aginut, which is funded by us. You know, it comes from Bituch Lumi money. They told the man, we will give you 40,000 shekel, we will pay the debt for you to give the get. The man agreed. He sent the get. It got lost in the mail. And so right now, he in theory gave the get, but no one knows where it is. At the same time, this woman has a psak from this other Beit Din outside the Rabbanut saying that she is single. Right now, this is going to the Supreme Court, and no one knows what to do with it.
Wow.
What's your opinion on something like this?
If I were to ask the paskin on the actual question, I would say it was false pretenses, it's mefechtod, that a get would not be required. Certainly, if there was no cohabitation after she became aware of this demand, it was the day after, etc. Now, the question you're raising, though, is, Robert Lewis took an opposite position. So, what can I say? The problem is like this. If you're asking me, under the law of the Torah, is she permitted to rely on the decision of an ad hoc method, she is definitely allowed to do that. So, in the eyes of Hashem, she is not committing any sin. But, Lamaisa, she's going to be considered an adulterer in the eyes of the Rabbanut and everything else. So, what are you going to do? Meaning to say, you can have the best heter in the world. If it's not going to be recognized by the state, that's going to create enormous complications. She will not be able to get married. Well, if she gets together, it's a little bit okay. But if she wouldn't get together, she would not be able to get married in Israel, and probably in America as well, unless the Dayanim are willing to marry her. And then, for other purposes,
so in cases like this, is an external Beit Din something that will help people, or will it cause further complications? Like in a case where, you know, where a man is clearly, he's using a marriage as an extortionary tool, because it has become an extortionary tool.
You know, I don't know what to answer. In other words, the external Beit Din has the right to pass it, and he has the right to follow it. But the premise is there are enormous complications. No children can be married. No children come to bed to sue in to let them go. They're going to be not there, so it's going to be...
It's a
purely
political issue.
It is. Yeah, I think when people make life decisions, they have to consider the impact on their children. That's part of the counter in proceedings. So this is a real, real sad case that Rabbi Netan Yerich and I did take not to work together. Thank you. Thank you very much, sir. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks. Thank you. Did you say you have any copies? Of this? Sure.